Welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. Joining me this week is Stephen Schleicher.
Hello.
And published author Rodrigo Lopez.
Hey, man.
What's up, everyone?
Not a whole lot.
Rodrigo, it's been a while since you've been on the show.
Yeah, what was What's the last thing I was on? I don't know. I think the end of the tour just, like, killed me, and then I haven't
It was just too much? You couldn't handle
it? I think we did Beasts of No Nation, so...
Oh, did you?
Were you on Beasts of... I don't remember that. Okay, cool.
Yeah, that was a heavy one.
Yeah, it was.
This week, a little bit different movie. We are talking Spike Lee's Chi-Raq. And to lead into this, I want to give a quick read of Justin Chang from Variety. He's the film chief film critic over there, and this is how he started his review of the film last month. It may not take much to make Spike Lee angry, but there's no denying he gives us reasons and then summons Chi-Raq, a sprawling, blistering State of the Union address that that presents Chicago's South Side as a cesspool of black-on-black violence, gang warfare, gun worship, and macho misogyny, ruled by unbreakable cycles of poverty and oppression. All that social outrage clearly demanded similarly outsized treatment, and Lee and co-writer Kevin Willmott have found a remarkably accommodating vessel in Aristophanes' Lysistrata, whose tale of an ancient Greek heroine leading an anti-war sex strike has been updated here as an alternately soulful and scalding, playful and deadly serious 21st century oratorio. And then he went on to tuck the review by... Sometimes I just love people, how they write film reviews, and I loved how he came into that. And I thought it gave a great starting point for our discussion of Spike Lee's Chi-Raq, which is from Amazon Studios.
Yeah, this is their first one.
Yeah.
This is their first movie release for Amazon Studios. And I was really surprised by that. I mean, obviously we knew about it, but just seeing the Amazon Studios logo come up at the beginning, I was like,
right.
Oh, okay.
Right, and I haven't read their full article, but I saw a headline from, I think, Hollywood Reporter or Variety today, saying that at Sundance this year, Amazon Studios and Netflix were the biggest buyers.
Yeah, they have the most stuff there.
Yeah, so very interesting turn of the tables for that. This movie has been out, I think, out for about a month in theaters at a very limited release.
Yeah, it's only had like, they've only brought in like $300,000 from theatrical release.
Yeah.
I don't know how much they've gotten through, 305 theaters, $1.2 million is how much it's grossed. So.
But then it swiftly came out on digital, obviously Amazon Studios, and then it ended up on iTunes fairly quickly as mm-hmm. well, which is where I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
So what I read from Variety kind of led into this, Spike Lee's newest film, Chi-Raq, is an adaptation from Aristophanes' Lysistrata, from 411 BC, telling the story of a woman who institutes a sex strike by bringing together the women so they can stop the Peloponnesian War. And now he's taking that story and taking it to the South Side of Chicago to do some very upfront and blunt social critiques of what's happening in Chicago and nationwide. What was your first thought of this, Rodrigo?
My first thought, I guess my first thought was this is not the best lyric video that I've ever seen, but it's not bad. Because we do get the entirety of that song up front.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very similar to the opening of, was it Do the Right Thing, I think, is where they had, or which one had Rosie Perez dancing?
Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost exactly mm-hmm. like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's a lot of Spike Lee-isms in this, you know, up front, play an entire song, have a surprising amount of musical numbers in it. Because if you've seen like She's Gotta Have It and stuff, it's like, what is this doing here? Okay, let's do it. I thought it was very slick. I thought it came from a very earnest place, definitely. That's, I guess, like my immediate thoughts are those.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what did you think of, like, the first scene where Samuel L. Jackson comes on and kind of sets the stage, at least for the dialogue in the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really like it. I mean, because... even though it is a modern adaptation, they kept the same rhyme and pattern mm-hmm. Of the source material, which I found very interesting. Mm. And to have Samuel L. Jackson and then the old men and the old women serving as the chorus throughout the piece,
right.
I thought was really, really a nice way to present the idea.
Yeah, I had never read Lysistrata, but I was familiar with, you know, old Greek stuff, and we've read in high school. So I, at first, was a little off guard because I think I wasn't completely paying attention yet when, through Samuel Jackson's initial dialogue, and then just immediately goes into a long rap scene, essentially, and then eventually we start getting the characters talk. And Aubrey wasn't paying attention. She's like, "What? Do people don't really talk like that? What are they doing?" I was like, "No, I think they're the thing. I think we missed something. I think they're doing a thing. We'll just go with it." But we've seen people do this before. Baz Luhrmann did it in Romeo and Juliet when he updated it with Leo DiCaprio. I'm trying to think of anything recently.
I mean, that's. I mean, there was a Richard III did it when they updated that. And there have been a couple others where they kept the same type of delivery of the source material.
That's what's interesting. You do see that in Shakespeare adaptations, and definitely Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet is probably the biggest one we can point to, where they keep the same language, maybe chop it up a little, and then use kind of modern visuals and relationships to kind of, like, between the words and whatever to show new stuff. But this play is like, or this movie, it's like modern parlance in that, like, can't, right? Like, with that scheme. So it's not like they're not using Aristophanes' words, not word for word. There's a lot of stuff that gets, like, thrown in here. But the characters still kind of speak in that. I don't think it's iambic pentameter, but it's something.
No, it's not.
Something like that.
It has a rhyme and a rhythm to it.
Do you think it worked well in updating the language to modern times, but then keeping that scheme instead of, you know, what we've seen like in Romeo and Juliet, keeping that original language? Do you think it still worked and adapted well to the 21st century?
It's interesting because, you know, you mentioned Samuel L. Jackson at the beginning, and he comes out and he has a speech. He has a presentation. If you think back to Do the Right Thing, he does the almost the exact same thing as the DJ for the neighborhood and what's going on there. And he's talking about it and he's using that. So I think that there's, you know, obviously some similarities there because of the way that it's presented. Most modern audiences are very familiar with lyrical speech, whether it be through rap or rock or whatever. I don't think that the delivery method in the speaking pattern, I don't think that that hinders the message. And it is something that a lot of people would recognize very easily.
Because it is, I think from some people, it can be a turnoff of dialogue when they you know they stretch the boundaries of what how people normally talk and how they converse.
But this wasn't but this isn't that way though. I mean, if you look at this as a spoken word rap, that's how this story is played out in that way. And I didn't have a problem with following along with it. Rodrigo, did you?
I did not. And I think, you know, that sort of that kind of meter and rhyme using things that we associate with older stuff, especially, you know, super old Greek plays, which is where drama comes from. It has this effect that it really, if done properly, and I think Chirac does it properly, it really elevates the work, right? It really makes it seem like it is important and valid, which is something that, you know, the plight of the modern urban black person desperately needs in the media.
One thing that I found a little off to my ears through it was not in the dialogue, but some of the soundtrack. I felt like we would get like the beginning, you know, they go to a rap song, very beginning, you get a little bit of dialogue, and then Nick Cannon performs another rap on stage. And then you get into moments of like Lysistrata and one of the character, and you have kind of a, quote, classical soundtrack, you know, orchestral piece underneath it. And those kind of run throughout. And I felt it was an to me, it felt like it was a weird juxtaposition of when we were jumping between musical styles. And I at times I thought maybe it was just a mixing and that was just too much. And they didn't subtly play it. But did anyone else have that thought while watching it?
Not really. I mean, I thought that they, as Rodrigo said at the beginning of the movie, you're playing the whole song and then you almost immediately go almost into that exact same song all over again.
Yeah.
And this is something that Spike Lee has done before where he will play the entire or have the entire song run as part of the soundtrack while you're mm-hmm. seeing the montage of the city streets as they're trying to track down who killed the little girl. These kinds of things, which I think would work fine. I think you kind of pointed out where if Liz Estrada is talking and her music is different from maybe another character, that the music then is being used as a narrative, as mm-hmm. here's how this group is being portrayed by music and how this group is being portrayed by music. So in that sense, I don't have a problem with it. I'm not sure what Spike Lee's involvement was with the music, because there's some controversy around the musical in here where they basically had submissions where people could submit the music to be included in the movie. Mm-hmm. And the person who was in charge of the music was charging people to submit their stuff.
Wow.
And
I missed that story.
And so when that fell out, the guy was fired. Yeah.
What'd you think about the soundtrack in this, Rodrigo?
It was interesting. And I think basically the soundtrack was kind of trying to hold all of these ideas together, right? You have modern urban Chicago, and that sounds a certain way. And then you have kind of ancient Greek comedy, which sounds a different way. Nobody in the audience is going to know what that sounds like. So we'll do something classical to evoke that, which mm-hmm. is what we're familiar with, right? You don't hear a lot of Greek music in this. So I think, sometimes the kind of like the hard bounce back and forth between musical styles is something that just kind of echoes what the movie is going through, because I feel that the movie actually kind of goes through some like serious tonal switches.
Yeah.
Throughout, and to me, that was sometimes a little jarring.
Mm. So let's talk about a little bit more of the story, and I got some of that stuff out of the way. Sure. Chirac is a story that is all about the violence in Chicago. It is pitting these two gangs, Spartans and Trojans, against each other.
How could you forget? It's based on a Greek play.
Well, I know
Spartans and Trojans going
obviously
after each other.
Nick Cannon is the lead of the, I'm gonna guess, I believe it was the Spartans, and then Wesley Snipes with an eye patch is the gang leader of,
and he is his
the
name
Trojans,
is
Cyclops.
Okay,
yes. And Nick Cannon's name, there is a story element, his real name, but he goes by Chirac throughout the piece. Gangs hate each other. They're fighting all the time. I think the story really starts picking up speed when a little girl is shot in a drive-by shooting, and then that is when the people come together, or Liz Estrada brings the women together, and they start their sex strike to try and end the violence in Chicago, and which then spreads to the rest of the world, and it kind of plays out from there, and a lot of different strings and threads of the story kind of intertwine through that. Rodrigo, you said you had some issues with some tonal shifts throughout. Can you describe when those were happening for you?
Oh, sure. There's basically two moments in which really kind of took me out of it. The first one is John Cusack's like big diatribe at the funeral, right?
Right.
Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's not in rhyme. It's not in that cant, right? Mm-hmm. Like he just starts talking like a normal person would, and not at all like a strange Greek comedy personage. And then we go right back, and then later on you hear him talk that way. So it's not like he's the only person that doesn't talk that way or anything.
Right.
And that was jarring. The other time, really, is after the women take over the armory. It's kind of hilarious. And the rest of the movie, up until the very end, is played very much like a comedy, even though the first, I don't know, third of the movie is very serious, very, very serious. The last two-thirds of the movie, up until basically Chirac's, the person's trial at the very end, it's all very much seems to be played for laughs.
Which is, I think, really the big problem with the movie overall. When we talk comedy, comedy is a broad range of things, right?
Sure.
This is, as the subcategory where this belongs, is satire, right? Where they're trying to use humor to discuss a super serious subject, poke at officials, poke at people involved, those kinds of things. But unfortunately, it comes off, as Rodrigo said, as it just comes off as a comedy. And in some places, it really comes off as a farce, which is, again, another subset of comedy. All satire is comedy. Not all comedy is satire. And I watched a video. It was part of the iTunes bit. I don't know if you watched the behind the scenes stuff where Spike Lee is basically saying, look, we want to make sure that people know that this is satire and not comedy. And it's weird that in this 4 minute behind the scenes stuff, that's the main thing that they want, that that Spike Lee says in that entire piece. And unfortunately, I don't think, I mean, this is the problem when we look at Dr. Strangelove and other political satire pieces, is people miss the political part and they focus on the comedy part. And I think because audiences may not be super keen on the difference between comedy and satire, or, you know, where they fall within one another, I think a lot of the message is lost because there's too much silliness going on.
I think the issue with this movie is fundamental. It is at the very core of the pitch for the movie. If you're going to do an updated version of Lysistrata set anywhere, then you have to treat it like what it is, which is a comedy. It is basically the prototype for modern comedy. I mean, Lysistrata was like a new version of comedy when it first came out, basically back in like 400 or whatever. And it, you know, it's a comedy. It's a raunchy comedy at that.
Oh, yeah. In the play, there's a guy that comes on towards the end and he's just got this. It says in the play, he's carrying a heavy load. And it says,
I was reading, I spark noted Lysistrata and they went over that.
I mean, that all of that stuff, it's like if you've ever read an annotated version of Lysistrata, it's like constant annotations because it's constantly making like all of these little, like jabby cultural references from, you know, a thousand years ago. So it's the source material is kind of a farce. I mean, farce in the theatrical sense, not necessarily, not in the like, this is bad sense.
Right.
So to then attach this very serious, like message driven project to Lysistrata is a big issue because
it misses the mark.
If you don't know what's going to happen in the movie, if you don't know going in what Lysistrata, the movie or the play is, and what this movie is going to attempt to do, the moment that the women basically upend the world by being sexy over there, just like is just a massive tonal shift. I mean, it just changes things on you. Like, you can do a movie about a sex strike that actually isn't a comedy. You can do a movie, you can do a version of Lysistrata set in the South Side of Chicago. That is a comedy, but trying to bring all of this stuff together, all of the political message and the like looking straight at the camera, this is what's happening to us stuff, and merging it with Lysistrata means that at different times, this movie is different movies.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I think its biggest failing is. As I said, if audiences don't understand what's going on, it's lost. And that's the biggest shame, I think, in the movie, is that somebody's going to look at this and think of it as a ha-ha comedy. It's light humor when it's not.
Mm-hmm. I know there has been some criticism of the film from some Chicagoans, namely Chance the Rapper, if you guys are familiar. He's from Chicago. And when I think it was the trailer came out or the movie first came out, he started tweeting about it. And he pretty much said, I'll just read what he said. You're just going to have to deal with some a little bit of cursing. That shit gets zero love out here. Shit is goofy. And it's a bunch of people from not around here telling you to support that. The people that made that shit didn't do so to save life. It's exploitative and problematic. Mm. And Chance is a pretty big guy. He just got Chicagoan of the Year. Like last year, he helps with kids. And I think he's from the South Side. Lee responded to him, not in the vein of this is a satire of the thing. He just said that Chance was biased because his father is Rahm Emanuel's deputy of chief of staff.
Well, that is interesting.
Wait, it is interesting
because the name Chirac, which a lot of people in South Side apparently call Chicago. But it is it's a stain. It's a bad name for the city itself. Many people consider it that as a bad stain. And when Lee revealed the title of the film, the city was like, no, you can't call it that. We'd prefer you don't use that. If you do use that, we're going to take away all the tax credits that we did. And that was the Chicago mayor, Rahm Emanuel. Lee called him a bully and called all the Chicago aldermen bootlickers because of that decision to do that. So yeah, there's no love lost between Spike Lee and the city council and people who supposedly were giving tax credits to make sure that the film was shot entirely in Chicago.
Right. And I know I can't remember what the interview was. I think it was MSNBC. Spike said when they met with Rahm Emanuel before, and he said that they didn't want him to use that name just because it would hurt tourism and give the city a bad image, which I don't know if this movie necessarily gave the bad image, but it kind of, I mean, it is pointing out a serious issue in Chicago.
Right.
With the violence that is happening. Other people came out against it. Another rapper named Vic Mensa came out against it, and he was not happy with his depiction of the city and how Spike Lee did it. That one's interesting. Spike never addressed that one, but people online did because... if you'll recall in the very first scene with Nick Cannon, when he comes out on stage and is rapping, there is another guy on stage in like a gray shirt who has like some like yellow tipped hair. That's actually Vic Mensa on stage with him, who's also a rapper from Chicago. So people were calling him like, well, if you have such big issues with this, why were you in it?
Why are you in the movie?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you don't know, right?
Right. You don't know if what
like,
he was.
How like Jim Carrey, like tried to distance himself from Kick-Ass 2 after it, after he had been in it, after he had was like a very important character in it.
So do you think that Spike Lee tried to do too much with this? Because I had that thought going through it, because I think he's addressing a lot of different social messages throughout the entire film. There's some main ones, but he addresses them handily and is making almost up to the year references of issues that are happening, which really blew me away on how, when he was just dropping in names of, you know, these incidents that have happened.
Right.
I mean, just in a year, but it could have been, I mean, he had to be updating the script essentially when stuff would happen because they were that relevant. Do you think he just tried to do too much? And I'm not necessarily think he did, but there was just a lot in here that he was trying to address.
Again, because of the nature of satire, if he's going to go up and down the chain of everyone from the low to the high and then incorporate the world. Yeah, I think it from that standpoint, I think it works. I don't think he tried to bite off more than he could chew. I'm just not sure that satire was the best way to talk about this subject. Right. I mean, you look at something like School Days, that's comedy. That works when you're talking about race relations, especially among in the college area. I think that that's fine. But when we look at something like Do the Right Thing, that's not a comedy. And it's addressing something head on in a very straight way that I thought was very powerful and very meaningful. Mm-hmm. I think this just, I mean, I know what he's talking about. I'm sure most of the audience knows what he's talking about, but it just seems to be off target for some reason to me.
Mm. Yeah. I think, again, that like there's kind of nothing wrong with it, but, I feel that the message does kind of get conflicted because it's also an adaptation of Lysistrata. You know, on top of being this movie about violence in Chicago or violence in the United States, you know, because mm-hmm. again, you know, stuff gets addressed, the military industrial complex, the like prison complex, mm-hmm. the NRA, all of these things get thrown in here. And it's kind of fine if that's what your movie's about. But also, this movie tries to be a pretty tight adaptation of the play, which means there are scenes in which people are like discussing it and it's funny because the play's a comedy, you know. And it's like, if you think of something like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is an adaptation of the Odyssey, it is a very loose adaptation of the Odyssey. And that's why it's a comedy, unlike the Odyssey. I think this is something that could have benefited from a lighter draw from the source material to kind of maybe not have like, oh, in this scene, there's this chorus of old men and chorus of old women. And like suddenly, you know, Demetrius walks out and he sees the fates before him kind of stuff.
Right.
It's like that stuff didn't necessarily need to be in there. Unless that's what you're going for. Unless you want to do a blow-by-blow adaptation of a Greek play set in the south side of Chicago. But if what you want is to draw attention to these conflicts, then the thousand-year-old play is going to get in your way.
Yeah. I mean, I say it's on target, but I mean, if you're looking at a bullseye, this is like to the right of the bullseye by quite a bit. I mean, it's not off to the edge, but I mean, it's a solid attempt. And so, you know, we've seen Spike Lee try to do a lot of different things I shouldn't say try. He does do a lot of different things to try to experiment, to see what he can do and stretch his legs while still being focused on the messages that he wants to get across. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that this missed the mark completely. I just don't think I think that there would be a better way to address violence in Chicago or wherever else. I think there's a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, so much of the time I was sitting there going, why is it being told this way? This doesn't make sense to be using this method to tell this message.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, I think it's a good film. I don't think it's a great film.
Mm.
I think it's an okay film. Is it one of Spike Lee's best films? No, I don't think it is that.
Yeah, something we haven't really talked to, just because I think the what he's trying to do with the violence is such a really a pivotal part of the play. But the adaptation is all about the sex strike that Lysistrata it puts on, and he gathers the women to do this. So what did you think about so that was essentially, I think, the funniest part where the comedy really came in. For that, do you think that played out well in just that aspect? Did you think that kind of worked? Was it believable? I don't know. What did you think about let's just start with the character, the actress?
Well, there's a couple of questions there.
Well, I know, because I didn't know where I was going with it.
Is the All withholding right, so, sex yeah. the withholding sex to control?
Yeah.
To, you know, no pussy, no peace.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work in this piece? In this film, in this world, of course it does.
Yeah.
The character of Lysistrata has a very weird and sudden awakening.
Yeah.
From a character where she's going from Chirac's boyfriend and the woman across the street who she does not know. Her house gets burned down, and so suddenly she moves in this woman, and instantly she's ready to go on this crusade without really going through a change process, mm-hmm. in my opinion. The actress, what's her name?
Tiana Paris.
Tiana Paris. I thought she was fine. Mm. I don't know what else. I don't know if I've seen her in anything else.
I saw her in Dear White People. Which came out, right. Well, a little bit ago. She was really good in that.
Okay. She was fine.
Yeah.
I really didn't have a problem with any of the acting. I think because of the way that the pieces are delivered at times, the acting feels stiff or it feels forced, mm-hmm. but that is more in the delivery of the rhyme than the actor's ability to emote feeling or anything through that. So mm-hmm. from those things, I don't have a problem with any of that. Rodrigo?
Let's see. Funny movie about a sex strike definitely works, only mostly hindered by the first third of the movie. But if you get dropped in right at the point where that guy's like, I know how we'll smoke him out, we'll play him slow jams.
Yeah.
Like, it's a pretty effective comedy. That, and you know, they change the world, you know, right down to like that, like super weird thing at the end where they're like, and all the Fortune 500 companies have agreed to hire everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, cool. Yeah, as a comedy, that part works. But again, it's kind of swimming in a vast ocean of a bunch of other stuff, right? And that's an issue. As far as Tiana Paris, I think she does a great job. You know, Liz Estrada as a character, I will agree that basically Helen tells her this stuff and she's like, you know what? This seems like a good idea. And then she's the main crusader for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's maybe not the most believable thing, but...
Now, granted, there is a scene where she's walking down the street and there's the dead child. That's how we're introduced to the main right. conflict. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of upset because there are no witnesses. But she sits down with Miss Helen, played by Angela Bassett, and she's like, oh, is that your daughter? And you kind of get the feeling that the daughter's dead, but there's nothing right. in the conversation between right. Miss Helen and Liz Estrada that is provoking enough to make a radical change in this person.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, that's not the strongest turn, not the most obvious turn, but it's there. I mean, again, you know, you're talking about people that live in like pretty extreme conditions within the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not that crazy for her to be like, you know what, we need to do something about this, you know, to be convinced to do something about this. But I think Tiana Paris does a great job. She has a real physicality that's very cool. You know, she basically has to perform that oath
mm-hmm.
That the women swear. And it's super cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's like... I don't know. There's just a lot of stuff that you're always kind of drawn to her, not just because the cinematography is very good. But, you know, there's like her as an actress. She just has like a real spark to her, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A character arc that I thought was strange and I don't feel like it paid off very well was Nick Cannon's Chirac character. I felt that the twist at the end when it was revealed that he killed the girl was telegraphed the moment the girl died, and Liz Estrada looked at the girl and like there was no witnesses, and she right. just kind of looked at her and just like yeah. walked away. I'm like, yeah, because, oh, okay, well, I know how this is going to play out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there was that twist of the reveal of his name and his father, who also
right.
gang member, who realized that you don't kill children or bystanders. And if you do, you beg mm-hmm. forgiveness and you accept
turn yourself in.
Yeah, you turn yourself yeah. in and accept the change. I think that mm-hmm. was probably the most interesting part of that final act
yeah.
where Chirac is just like, no, I'm not signing this peace accord. Screw it, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you think Cannon did a decent job acting? I can't even remember if I've ever really seen him act before or if there's anything I've actually would have seen him in.
I mean, I think he does fine, but... we don't spend a lot of time with him.
Like, no,
this is very much Liz Estrada's movie, and he disappears for a long time. It's like we basically see almost as much of Cyclops as we do him.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not quite, but yeah, I mean, this is, and again, it's one of the many things that's kind of a crossed wire in this movie is like, this is an adaptation of Liz Estrada. So Liz Estrada is the main character, right? Mm-hmm. But the movie is called Chi-Raq, and you're like, okay, well, it's a reference to what they call Chicago, but it's like, no, also the main character is named Chi-Raq.
Right.
But this is not his movie. This is his girlfriend's movie.
And also, he's right? top billed in the whole yeah. thing. Yeah.
Well, sure, but you're going to have
you get
that.
The, you get I the mean, name thing.
I'm surprised John Cusack isn't the top billed here, yeah, because that's just Hollywood, right?
That is the yeah. weirdest. It's the weirdest casting part of the movie, I think.
John Cusack.
John Cusack.
Yeah. Because
John Cusack having swallowed like a handful of gravel.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because I mean, I don't know. It's just the weirdest thing. And especially in his delivery, as he's a Catholic priest doing a you know, what you would imagine would be Southern Baptist presentation at a funeral. That's, again, it doesn't seem appropriate for a funeral. It's just, it was the weirdest scene in the whole movie, was that thing. It was powerful. It was interesting, but it was just weird to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because it introed that whole scene with like a full musical number.
Right.
And yeah.
I have some ideas of why Spike Lee may have wanted to cast a white actor in role.
It's based off of a real person in Chicago. Okay. Yeah.
Now, do his attendants wear Crusader markings and emblems on their clothing?
That I'm not sure of, but I can look it up really quick.
Okay.
The beginning of the film when they're doing the statistics.
Yeah, yeah.
And the voiceover at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
That's the character, or the human John Cusack's actually playing.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that is why.
Okay. No, that's
he
fine.
Cast him like that.
No, that's fine.
Well, and it makes sense. And also, I think, again, this movie is, let's say, direct when it's basically telling you this is this movie's message, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think it makes sense to basically be like, okay, well, while we're at it, here's kind of what a white ally to a black cause looks like, right? He's concerned about the government. He's not pulling any punches. He's not saying, well, we'll take care of this later, but let's focus on this other thing first. He's not sugarcoating it. He's not doing anything. He's saying like, yes, your plight is real. Your problems are real. All this stuff is real. Nobody's saying anybody who says they're not is in the pocket of some other guy, right? It's kind of like putting those words to a white person gives it is an example to white people of kind of how to be allies to the plight of the people of color. That said, it does happen as he severely railroads a child's funeral.
Yeah.
So it's like, on top of that, it's like, well, maybe this is what would happen.
Well, I was just curious because, you know, his attendants, his quote unquote bodyguards, are wearing the Crusader cross on their clothing, very much like the Crusaders who would swoop in and try to appropriate a whole region for their religious purposes. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if in my mind, as I'm watching this and I see that, I'm like, oh, is he trying to say John Cusack is trying to appropriate, which he does in that scene, appropriate the cause for his own means. I don't know. It was the most interesting scene and the weirdest scene in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. When we talked about Do the Right Thing, way back when, almost the beginning of Zach on Film, one of our big discussions was on Spike Lee's use of color throughout the piece. We get a little bit of that, I feel like, similarities with Spartans and Trojans with the orange and purple, which get played out throughout most of the film. Do you think he used colors in any other ways that is reminiscent of Do the Right Thing? Because that movie was just red on top of red on top of red, the whole thing. Do you see any similar color palettes like that or other clothing colorations?
I really didn't notice it that much because it was everything seemed to be a very muted, toned down stuff. I mean, the obvious colors of the Trojans and the Spartans, the purple and the orange, is probably the thing that would stand out the most. But the city of Chicago does not. I mean, it has a dull color, Maybe that's how you're supposed to feel. Maybe that's how the citizens feel, mm-hmm. is they've been dulled to all of this stuff. I don't know. I just didn't really see anything there.
Yeah.
There's kind of this drab, like literal, like olive drab change to the women as they join the cause. And basically when they take over the armory, they're kind of wearing camo stuff.
Right.
You know, and they go from wearing their gang colors to wearing that stuff kind of unified. And then at the end, everybody's wearing white except for Chirac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like an overwhelming amount of people wearing white and then one guy in purple, right? So right. There's obviously that probably right there was the moment when I'm like, here is a filmmaker using color to make a statement.
Yeah. Yeah. some interesting casting choices, I thought. Wesley Snipes was in there. He played a very interesting character, I thought, especially in his vocal cues were all over the place.
Which was, I think it was, again, there's like, there are all of these fun, interesting, cool things about this movie that kind of don't play out.
Yeah.
I wanted to see more of Wesley Snipes doing that guy.
Yeah.
I wanted to see an actual confrontation between those two where, you know, Nick Cannon is playing it all like tough, straight up gangster. And, you know, Cyclops is this kind of like kind of guy.
The only time we get that is when Cyclops is driving away from the burning house at the beginning. When they're interacting with one another. Yeah.
Well, he has a conversation with, amazingly, Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, oh, my God. When he showed up, I was like, holy crap, Dave Chappelle's in this movie.
Yeah, I had no idea that he was going to be in the movie. And when I saw him, basically, I saw him and I'm like, is that? And then he started talking. And Dave Chappelle has a very recognizable voice. I was like, oh, my God, that's Dave Chappelle. Is this the first thing he's done?
Yeah, probably in a long time. I was really saying, oh, well, if he's got Dave Chappelle, maybe Chris Rock is going to be in this. Maybe Eddie Murphy would show up in this in some way, shape, or form. I mean, I could really see Eddie Murphy playing the lieutenant mayor, the guy that was really kind of straight-laced, the guy that was trying to control everything and try to stop the situation. I could see Eddie Murphy playing that character. But yeah, seeing Dave Chappelle was really cool in this.
Yeah.
According to IMDb, this is the first thing he's done since like 2007.
Wow.
And then we over John Cusack's kind of smallish role. And then Jennifer Hudson played a really important role in the film. It wasn't huge, but it was very important, which I found is interesting. I didn't know Jennifer Hudson was from Chicago. And in watching that iTunes behind the scenes stuff, that her whole family, or not her whole family, but three members of her family were killed in Chicago through violence. So obviously some personal stuff went into this film for her as well. So overall, Steven, you said you didn't think this movie stacked up quite well.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
It's not a great movie.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting in its delivery and in using the Lysistrata story to kind of go about it. Aubrey watched it with me and she thought it was really interesting, just I think from the dialogue and how it kind of played out. And she didn't think it was great by any stretch of means, but when she described it to her parents later, she's like, well, it was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's worth a watch.
You know, last week I talked about The Big Short.
Yeah.
And how it's a weird movie, but it's a movie that you probably ought to see because of the way that they're presenting information in a way that a typical film narrative is not presented in.
Right.
This movie is the exact same way. It's a very good, a very good movie. But I think even though the message may be lost in places, seeing how a modern adaptation of this Greek play is being done, I think it's very fascinating. And how they use the elements from the comedy in this, I think, is really well done. And for a modern satire, I think it's very well done. So from that side, I really do think that people should check it out because of what is what they're attempting to do in the movie, just like with The Big Short.
And so would you recommend this movie to anyone, Rodrigo?
I would. Just kind of depends. I think there's essentially a few groups of people that would be super into this movie. Obviously, Spike Lee fans. I think, mm-hmm. you know, people who are into Greek plays, I'd be like, hey, did you ever see Spike Lee's adaptation of Lysistrata? Like, because it is that. And honestly, it tends to kind of trip over itself because it's trying to do two things. But it's kind of weirdly effective at both of those things. The mm-hmm. problem is that those two things pull the movie in two separate directions, right? Mm. So, I mean, that's fundamentally the only problem that I had with this movie. I think it looks great. I think the acting is good. I think the messages are good. I think the idea of adapting this play and setting it in Chicago is a great idea. I think the use of the term Chirac as a title is great. It's strong. It's controversial. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it is problematic, but it's kind of that, like, is this, like, yeah, it's like we're addressing a problem, sort of problematic, right? It's kind of what you want. You know, and the problem is that it just kind of pulls itself in too many directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I, like you said, I thought visually, I thought it was very, good to look at. I thought the cinematography was nice. Once I adjusted to the dialogue in about two scenes, I really enjoyed, the way they played with the rhyming and then just the structure of it. Having seen now two Spike Lee movies, I definitely don't, I don't think this stacks up to do the right
thing. Well, no, listen, I think really if you want to see something that's comparable, there's two other movies that you could watch that would kind of be on. One would be the opposite end of the spectrum, Malcolm X, right? Obviously see that. But look at A School Days, which I thought was very similar to what this was. Okay. School Days musical, but it still kind of falls into the same kind of category.
Okay.
I would really
Did you guys ever see Inside Man?
No.
So that's Inside Man is Spike Lee doing like a bank heist movie. It's super, like, it's really interesting. It's like, I want to say Denzel Washington's the main character. It's like, and it's not nearly as politically charged as most of the things that Spike Lee does, mm-hmm. but it is. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interestingly, the cinematographer on this, you like the cinematography, Matthew Labatique. He works with Darren Aronofsky a lot. He did Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, and Black Swan.
Oh, wow.
In that. So for people that are wondering why the cinematography is fantastic.
Yes.
There's a reason why.
Yeah. You guys, any final thoughts, things you want to cover over Chirac?
There's not, you know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of information about production.
Yeah.
That's readily out there unless you're reading through a lot of archives of Chicago papers. So that's somewhat disappointing. There's just more interviews about why are you approaching this subject matter, but nothing really about the actors, what they had to go through, what the production had to go through, anything like that that I found.
Yeah.
It's a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Rodrigo, thank you so much for being on the show again this week.
Oh, my pleasure.
We hope that you're back again soon. Next week, I think we might be heading to the theaters because the Coen Brothers movie is coming out.
If our theater is going to get it.
You know what? I already checked. They already have it up.
We're actually not owned by a subpar company anymore.
AMC.
Actually, we're owned by AMC.
Well, there you go. Issues.
Somebody actually reached out today and said, oh, I just heard your episode about how AMC ruined Christmas. Oh, I feel so bad for this. Well, there you go.
So next week we will be doing the new Coen Brothers movie, Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar.
Looking forward to that. In the meantime, head over to MajorSpoilers.com. Find so much news and comic reviews and podcasts to fill your days before the next week's episode of Zach on Film. While you're there, click on an Amazon.com link. And Rodrigo, do you have any suggestions what anyone should buy over at Amazon.com?
Yeah, I would suggest that you buy a little book called The Tale of Tallest Rabbit. It is by Rodrigo Lopez, who is me. I'm the author. I wrote it. And I think it's very enjoyable. Fun for the whole family.
There you go. Head over to Amazon, buy that. Use the Amazon.com link at majorspoilers.com. That book will not cost you any extra. It'll be the same exact price, but a little bit.
Actually, Amazon keeps lowering the price. It's like $3 off right now. So
what
run.
A steal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Type like the wind. Buy it now. Help Major Spoilers. Support Rodrigo. Everyone wins. So next week, we will be talking Hail Caesar on Zach on Film.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.